Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists is Dr. Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. He is one of the nation's leading strategists and most prolific national security authors, as adept at great power competition as counterinsurgency warfare. This conversation is part of our series dedicated to the memory of one of the nation's greatest strategists, Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. And this conversation is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, that also sponsors our coverage of strategy. Michael, thanks so very much for joining us.
Vago, great to be with you today.
An absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And Peretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Michael, the timing of this conversation is great, right? In part because we have a new administration that's taking office that looks like it's going to take a different strategic direction. You also have a new book coming out. Our favorite topic is strategy. And your book is The Art of War in an Age of Peace, U.S. Grand Strategy and Resolute Restraint. There's enormous debate about the era that we're in, the nature of future war, the right way to deter it, how to engage with problematic nations like China, which the new administration is trying to do this as it seeks to resuscitate alliances and partnerships around the world. And now we have what could be regarded as actually an existential threat that we face, right? Generally, that's reserved for nuclear weapons, but now we have a domestic terrorist element, heavily armed, homegrown radicals that are motivated and seeking to overthrow the U.S. government. How do we need to think about where we are and the strategy we need to go forward?
Well, big questions, Vago, of course, and we'll come back to the last one. I don't know how to begin with that one. So let me just say for the moment that while I do believe that what happened on January 6th in Washington was in effect the culmination of a slow motion coup attempt, I don't believe that most of the proponents of that school of thinking or politics really are in open insurrection against the United States on a sustained basis. We'll see. But I'm hopeful, but still scared and certainly sobered by what happened just a couple weeks ago. But now let me come back to America and the world. And thank you for kindly noting the title of my forthcoming book. I know this is not a book talk, but let me just harp on two ideas in the title and subtitle that I think begin to answer your question. One is the overall title, The Art of War in an Age of Peace. I want to have an oxymoronic tension to this title, because I believe that the world is actually today safer, more prosperous, more stable, and more successful than the preponderance of certainly newspaper headlines, but even of most of my fellow strategic and military thinkers would suggest. I don't believe we're likely headed for war with Russia or China. I don't believe their ambitions are such that we have to take that kind of concern overly seriously. And yet I also want to take it somewhat seriously. I think we need to stay focused on the art of war, not just in kinetic and lethal terms, but also with the full range of our economic tools. And here, the Trump legacy may actually offer at least an insight or two, even though overall I'm not a supporter of that president and what he did with this country or its foreign policy. I do think that thinking more holistically about our economic toolkit and integrating that with our military toolkit is the right way to continue to develop the art of war, especially for an era where I believe that any challenges from Russia and China are more likely to be nibbling away at the edges, where a sort of escalatory military response may be foolish on our part. And then the other big idea I wanted to start with is this notion of resolute restraint, which again sounds slightly oxymoronic on purpose. What I'm really trying to say is that I do believe we have to be resolute in defense of just two or three core elements of what I call the rules-based global order. I stay away from the term liberal order. It's too expansive. It's too starry-eyed for my taste. But the rules-based order, which is the territorial sovereignty and integrity of the United States and its major allies, and of the sea lanes and airspace that connect us and allow for global commerce, together with controls on weapons of mass destruction, and especially nuclear weapons, these to me are the core elements of the rules-based order that we must be absolutely resolute in defending and being willing to risk war to preserve. But I don't believe in using U.S. military power or further alliance expansion or war plans to defend what you might consider the secondary or third order, the tertiary elements of the global order, or to promote a liberal order of democracy, human rights, et cetera. I think those kinds of pursuits, however worthwhile, let's say the political evolution of Ukraine or Georgia, for example, these should be handled in other non-military ways, and we should not confuse or conflate them with the core interests and allies over which we must be willing to fight if necessary. So it's resolute in the sense, the strategy is resolute in the sense of being absolutely unflinching in how we must continue to prepare for the art of war in defense of key interests and allies. But it is restrained in not favoring more NATO expansion, having more patient war plans that don't rush to escalation in the event of small-scale conflict, and a few other ways that I hope we can get into.
And one of the points you make, right? I mean, one concern you have is almost like nobody wanted to get into World War I. Folks were preparing for it. And then because of a whole series of complex alliance structures, it triggered mechanisms that put the great powers at war, which they then dutifully fought. You could have said actually World War II was very similar, right? The United Kingdom had an agreement to defend Poland. Once Poland fell, the United Kingdom was committed to war against Germany and its allies. The question is one of balance, right? The United States and even European powers have been remarkably reluctant to confront meaningfully misbehaving powers, right? You could look at the penalties against Russia have been extremely mild, especially now that it's coming to light that actually the number of assassinations committed by Russia may be actually quite large, larger than we had expected on U.S. territory, in Europe, and elsewhere around the world, even here in Washington, D.C. China continually transgressing. And yet the Obama administration put a climate deal ahead of it. So sort of had a tendency of trying to suppress or tamp down notions of a belligerent China. Certainly no desire for talk about competing against Russia. That became sort of the Trump mantra. And you're right. A lot of positive things came of this, even though if the strategy was somewhat disorganized. How do we get this balance right? Because we're dealing with two authoritarian great powers that will take advantage of every opportunity. And in fact, we saw that with China, right? Struck a trade deal with Asia and Europe. There was language in that trade deal to say human rights is important, or human rights are important. And then what does China do? The ink isn't even dry, cracks down in Hong Kong and actually pays no price for it. How do we get this balance right?
Yes. Well, if I could start with history, because you alluded to World War I and World War II. And what haunts me about World War I, and I worry that it could in some partial way echo today, is the Schlieffen plan, the German plan, whereby they sent most of their military into France through Belgium early in the war, trying to win that war in a month and a half so they could then swing east and also defeat Russia and do all this in an exquisitely pre-programmed way that required that once war seemed a likelihood, they had to make sure they were first to be off the mark. That was a terrible, terrible way to think about military planning because it greatly increased the risks of war occurring in the first place. And then, of course, magnified the dangers of escalation. And I don't think we would be as, frankly, foolish or bloody-minded as the German leaders were of that period. And I don't have any problem with showing them zero sympathy whatsoever and being quite critical. I think we are a little kinder as a nation and a little smarter as a nation than that. However, the idea of writing war plans in secret and wanting to be very resolute and rapid in our response and, you know, the talk in the national military strategy of being effective in the contact and blunt phases, the very early phases of an enemy attack. Some recent writing that suggested we need a capability to sink 350 Chinese ships in the first 72 hours of conflict. These kinds of ideas make me worry that we could find ourselves falling back into Schlieffen plan-like ways of over-rapid escalation. And almost because we assume that somehow the war has become likely or inevitable, the same way European leaders in the early 1910s thought that war was a likelihood, so you better make sure you're not second to the punch. To the extent you think like that, it's really dangerous. And I think there are more lessons from World War I today than there are for us from World War II. Now, with World War II, you're right, there were some echoes of World War I, but the big thing is that Britain was not really in a position to defend Poland in those days. It didn't have forward military deployments, wasn't really stronger than Germany. It was a situation where even backing up their promises was going to be somewhat challenging. They could have tried. If we had helped them, maybe we could have been successful, but we had so demilitarized by then that we were not perfecting or maintaining the art of war. We sort of gave up on the art of war after World War I. We decided that we just didn't want to be involved in that again. And guess what? We may not have wanted war, but war still had an interest in us. So what I'm happy about in today's world is that our alliances are usually backed up by forward deployed American military power, which I want to keep forward deployed. And so that's a part of the answer to your actual question on what do we need to do to defend the most important countries and interests around the world that we feel we must cherish and treat as if they were our own sovereign territory, at least with a comparable willingness to risk American bloodshed. I think we need forward deployed American forces and working alliances. In certain other situations, however, I think that the economic sanctions toolkit is the much more promising and appropriate mechanism, even if it won't always deliver immediate results. Some people would say sanctions have failed, for example, in response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine. And I say, well, if your only goal was to get Crimea back for Ukraine or to stop Russia from stoking separatist violence in eastern Ukraine, then I guess you're right. But my goal there, my main goal as an American strategist is to make sure that NATO remains intact and safe and secure, and that the Russians don't think that NATO is so weak as to be vulnerable to an ongoing and expanding Russian set of aggressions that could even then go next to the Baltic states. And in that regard, I think the mix of economic sanctions with the implied threat to do more if aggression gets worse, together with some of NATO's increased forward deployments in the Baltic states and Poland, that's been the right mix. It didn't involve war fighting. It didn't involve the United States even putting special forces into Ukraine for combat purposes, but it involved a mix of non-lethal military tools, or at least non-kinetic employment and deployment of military tools, combined with economic sanctions that were partly intended to punish, but also intended to signal that we as an alliance were still together and we could do much more if need be. So that's the way I start to think about some of the problems on the world stage today. And I don't want to get into every possible scenario, but just very quickly on China, I would suggest that if, for example, China winds up putting 100 troops ashore in one of the Senkaku Islands, those uninhabited islands in the East China Sea that are controlled by Japan, but claimed by both Japan and China, that we are sworn to help Japan defend, even though we don't have an official U.S. position on whose islands they should be. If we wake up one day and China's got 100 of its forces ashore one of those islands, I do not favor immediately bombing or counter-invading that position. I favor using this mix of modified and enhanced U.S. military deployments without drawing first blood, to combine with economic sanction strategies as the appropriate kind of response. So that's the way I would begin to answer your question.
What are the, you mentioned that sinking 350 Chinese ships in the first 72 hours may not be a wise strategy, but what are the capabilities that you think we need regarding China or aimed at Russia to preserve and maintain deterrence, right? There's this concern the Chinese are moving so fast that we have actually a remarkably small window in which to sort of assert our deterrence, right? Before the Chinese miscalculated a certain point. Where do you think that point is? What's our window? What are the specific capabilities you think are going to be most valuable to us?
Well, let me do this in response to the National Defense Strategy and to some of Jim Mattis's thinking when he was Secretary of Defense. And I certainly admire Jim Mattis as much as the next guy. And I think a lot of what was in that National Defense Strategy was good, but I also have one issue with it. So in terms of what was good, the effort to put more money into research and development to try to restore an emphasis on innovation and modernization, to build on the latter Obama years of Ash Carter and Bob Work and Paul Selva and Joe Dunford and their concept of a third offset, and then to take that to the next level of competition and investment. All that's good. That part I agree with. What I don't agree with is the implication that if we do that, we will regain the kind of preeminence that we used to have in the Western Pacific in maritime domains. In other words, where the Pacific is almost an American lake, all the way up to, you know, when you're within eyesight of the Chinese coastline. That was never a very natural state of affairs. China has become way too much of a near peer rival for that kind of, you know, historical anomaly to be recreated. And technology itself means that there are enough sensors and precision strike weapons out there that if you're within close proximity to a major military power, certainly a military power with more than a $200 billion a year defense budget, you are not going to be able to reclaim that kind of essentially, you know, carte blanche opportunity or ability to operate without being in harm's way. And so we just got to get over the idea that we're going to recreate the ability to, let's say, easily defend Taiwan because we have somehow restored the kind of conventional edge we used to have. That's just not going to occur.
Let me ask you about how we strike this right balance, right? The concern has been that we are so eager, for example, to strike a climate deal that we're willing to sort of sweep under the rug more important and thornier and more complex issues at the end of the day. And the Chinese are very adept at interconnecting everything, right? We as Western nations have a tendency of compartmentalizing, right? I can be mad with the United Kingdom on one thing, but still be a NATO partner and do a whole bunch of other things. China has a much more integrated strategy of aligning all the arms of national power to pressure every single point, for example, on Australians, whether on mining or foodstuffs or wine or beef or anything else, suspending deliveries because Canberra had the temerity to suggest an investigation on the origin of the coronavirus, for example. And in fact, it's a very successful strategy. The Chinese stopped buying German cars. Germany became a great advocate for a trade deal that resumed exports of German cars. And Australia participated in a trade deal because it was like, wow, you know, I have limits. I'm a small nation. How do we get this balance right and not strike deals, right? I mean, because the Chinese don't seem to be terribly moved, Michael, about whether or not there is a climate deal, right? So how do we get this right with an adversary, a competitor, that has a fundamentally different view of how this game needs to be played than we do?
Well, first of all, I guess begin by saying let's not link too much. I think it's a strength of ours, not a weakness, that we are able to prioritize and that we don't quickly jump the gun and, you know, throw the kitchen sink at a country because they have a specific disagreement with us. Again, I want to distinguish between the rules-based order, where I think we need to be completely resolute and focused and unflinching in our defensive interests, for example, access to the South China Sea and the sea lanes there, versus the liberal order and some of the more loftier or longer term goals that we might have, like getting the best climate deal. And the latter are important, but they're of a different type. And I think they are issues where we should recognize that that's a challenge for the broader foreign policy of the United States. But the core national security policy of the United States in the short term is about territorial integrity of allies and American interests, protection of the American population, protection of sea lanes and airspace needed for global economics, and ensuring that weapons of mass destruction don't spread any more than absolutely necessary. And to me, that's where I don't want to be compromising or linking too many issues together. So, you know, I'm not really sure what particular concern I should have about the Chinese and climate change, but I guess what I'm saying is we shouldn't, and I don't think we will, start linking our alliance commitments in Asia to whether there's a climate deal or offering to somehow pull back from the South China Sea because there might be Chinese acquiescence in a climate deal. I don't believe in that kind of linkage because I think different problems require different tools. And on the core national security interests of the United States, we should not be compromising or somehow making our commitments hostage to progress on other issues that may be important in their own right, but are important in a different way, in a longer term sense, and not as much urgent national security matters.
H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor, joined us on this podcast some months ago, and he articulately made the case about the United States' tendency towards strategic narcissism, a tendency of thinking that we can solve all problems, and also a tendency of seeing our adversaries as we want to see them as opposed to how they actually are. Right. And that muddled thinking leads to a whole bunch of muddled calculations at the end of the day. From your standpoint, right. And if you look at it, and in even some military strategists, and you and I have discussed this, that sometimes the capabilities we deliver or are developing, or even the strategies we're using, aren't really synced to achieving the ends we want to achieve. Right. How do we get better, Michael, at the fundamental understanding of problems and how we solve them, right, as opposed to doing an overreactive solution, right? Sink their whole fleet in 72 hours, okay? Maybe. But, you know, how do we need to think about problems? How do we need to think differently about forming solutions that are more nuanced, much more integrated, less scattershot, and perhaps not as Pollyanna?
Well, thank you for the reference to HR and his concept of strategic empathy. And if I could, I'll try to draw that out in answer to your question. This is a tough thing to talk about, because if you really try to develop strategic empathy, in my opinion, you wind up risking like you're sounding soft on China and Russia. When in fact, again, on the core issues of allied sovereignty and security and defense of the sea lanes and global airspace, we cannot be unyielding or somehow understanding or flexible. But Russia views the period since the Cold War, and I think this is true for almost all Russians, not just Vladimir Putin, as a period in which the United States has thrown its weight around the world, largely at Russia's expense, and often with mediocre outcomes, and sort of were an incompetent bully in Russian minds and eyes. And we've done this from Kosovo to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to NATO expansion, to a number of other things. And you know, most of the time when Russians say this, they're reflecting their own view of their own history. And sometimes Putin in particular is quite petty and obviously self-serving in the way he uses this narrative to justify his own rule and his own bullying actions. But the Russians do believe it, for the most part. They do believe that we are sort of rubbing their face in the dirt after winning the Cold War, and that we do a lot of things, especially in the broader Middle East, that we don't think through very well. We don't really know how to use our power, that we foment democratic revolution anywhere we can, and we would happily do it inside of Russia if we could, and therefore we're even a threat to their regime. And this is the story they spin. Now, I've come to believe that's a genuine story, not just, again, not just an advertising campaign for somehow trying to wear down others and get us to do what Russia wants. I'm not suggesting we concede that Russia, however, is in the right. They're mostly in the wrong. But strategic empathy would suggest that when, at least to me, that when you're talking about Ukraine and Georgia or any other former Soviet republic, and we'll put an asterisk by the Baltic states for the moment, because they were never recognized as being part of the Soviet Union by Washington. But for the other Soviet republics, the idea of expanding NATO into that space, you know, we Americans can tell ourselves a happy story about how we're just promoting democracy and respecting other countries' sovereign rights to choose their own security associations. But to the Russian mind, that's BS, that's sacrosanct, you know, rhetoric that we don't necessarily even believe. And it just goes to show our hypocrisy, because we Americans would never tolerate that kind of infringement by another foreign power in our hemisphere, which is probably true, by the way. And so I think strategic empathy says, you know what, let's view Ukraine and Georgia and Belarus and Azerbaijan and Armenia as a little different category. But as you know, Vago, we've been committed publicly for 13 years to ultimately include Ukraine and Georgia within NATO. Right. I think that's a bad policy. And HR may disagree with me. I don't know if strategic empathy leads him to that same conclusion about NATO expansion as I reach. But that's an example of where taking that concept leads me down a thought path that makes me want to say to Russia, not that we'll give them something for nothing and somehow concede further NATO expansion just as a gesture of kindness or guilt. I'm not suggesting that at all. But if we can create a concept for a new neutral, non-aligned security architecture in these former Soviet republics, I think that would be to everyone's mutual benefit. And it would build on the idea of the Minsk II process for trying to resolve the Ukraine crisis as well. So that's where strategic empathy leads me. I could go off and do a similar digression on how I think about China, but I'll save that for later. That to me, however, is a really important concept that we should in fact try to employ, not because we want to be somehow understanding or kind to dictators, but because if we don't see where they're coming from, we're going to fail to anticipate how they react. And that could really lead us to problems that wind up being, counterproductive for our own interests, even if we can somehow defend them as morally justifiable.
I completely agree with you. And right, so would Brent Scowcroft, right? One of America's greatest strategists, right? Understand what the other guy wants. If you can sit where they're sitting and look at the situation differently, it'll help you, us, develop better strategies. Let me get your sense on China, right? And how we need to be thinking about China and how China sees the world and how that idea can help us craft better strategy.
Yeah. And by the way, thank you for lending your voice to this. And I would also note that there are a number of other prominent Americans who at one point or another, in addition to you, who would, in addition to many other voices, have critiqued or voiced skepticism about even previous rounds of NATO expansion, but certainly about any further NATO expansion. And they've done it on the record. So I can cite their names, Bill Burns, in his excellent memoir, The Back Channel, and Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, George Kennan, Tom Friedman. There are a lot of strategists who have just looked at this and said, if you really try to get inside the Russian mind, you're probably not even going to be helping Ukraine and Georgia if you say you want to bring them into NATO. You're probably just painting bullseyes on their back, especially when you go through this prolonged period where we're making no progress towards bringing them into NATO, but we still are on record as saying that we someday aspire to that. It's almost an exactly perverse set of incentives to offer up to Moscow. In regard to China, I was privileged to write a book about 7 years ago with Jim Steinberg, former Deputy Secretary of State Steinberg, and a brilliant guy who spent a lot of time thinking about China. And even back 10 years ago, when we started the book, he was predicting where the U.S.-China relationship was going to go, because he describes the United States in its own mind as the shining city on the hill that wants to spread democracy around the world because we think we're the champion of values that are universal, not just our own. And, I think we're largely correct to have that view. But China is the middle kingdom that, after centuries of isolation and retreat and, then a century of humiliation, starting with the Opium Wars of 1839, 1840, up through World War II, went through a period they never want to experience again. And whether they really want to take over the world or not, I'm dubious, but they certainly want to be first among equals within Asia and probably beyond. And they think their time has come and that our time has passed. And so you put all these ingredients together and you're bound to have a U.S.-China clash. Now, to the extent we do believe in democracy and human rights and sovereign rights for all nations, big and small, we should not retreat from our aspirations, but we should also be aware of what China is likely to do. And so to me, this leads to a number of perspectives on how to handle U.S.-China relations, especially around the periphery of China. But, I want to be resolute in defense of Japan and South Korea. I want to think of more promising ways to help Taiwan defend its sovereignty at a time when I'm not sure U.S. military power can dominate the Western Pacific like before, if a China-Taiwan war begins. But I don't want to egg on Taiwan to somehow look for that fight. And so I would, just as one example, I would strongly disagree with the recent decisions of the Trump administration to somehow say that we should normalize U.S. government dealings with Taiwan officials. I think this flies in the face of decades of more discreet policy. And frankly, we don't need Taiwan to get the trappings of sovereignty so much that we should be willing to risk U.S.-China war over that goal. And to me, that's an excellent example of where a liberal agenda conflicts with a more modest rules-based agenda. And you can keep dealing with Taiwan in ways that promote its autonomy and the rights of its people to an excellent life. And we should do that. But that should be more a part of our broader foreign policy. And our core national security policy doesn't need to prioritize pushing Taiwan towards a confrontation with China, which it probably can't win in any event. So a little bit of strategic empathy for China would suggest that Taiwan's special. And sure, we see it as a small underdog democracy against this big communist bully. But for the Chinese, it's part of their territory, it's part of their history. And they're also proud, by the way, of what their communist system has done for its own people. And they don't see the contrast between what they're doing internally and what Taiwan's doing quite as starkly as we do, because they're proud of the prosperity and much better lives they brought to many of their citizens in what's been historically unprecedented. So I think, you know, we need to spend a little bit of time, even as we get tough on China, remembering of all the excellent things China's achieved in modern decades, sometimes with our support, by the way. And we also need to avoid, you know, pounding our chest and getting our testosterone up and deciding we're somehow going to make the next level of Taiwan sovereignty or quasi-sovereignty a paramount goal of U.S. national security policy. To me, that's just foolish.
The question, and certainly from Xi Jinping's standpoint, right, he doesn't see capitalism with Chinese characteristics as the reason for China's success, right? He thinks that it's communism. And if we just double down on communism, we'll grow even faster. And I know there's a lot of debate, even among the princelings, about whether or not that strategy is correct. But one of the challenges here, Michael, and I know that some of the folks in the audience are probably asking themselves this, is at the end of the day, when strategies maybe are somewhat less than muscular, there's a tendency for nations with a high risk tolerance, and I would put China and Russia in that category, to sort of look at the tea leaves and for internal purposes, right, having fan nationalism, decide I'm going to take Ukraine and I will suffer no meaningful penalty. Or I just took Hong Kong, which is my number one goal. Nobody stopped me. And my second goal is to take by force Taiwan. And people will complain a little bit about it, but at the end of the day, I will have achieved my strategic goal. What are evidences that anything that is sanction-based, anything that is economics-based, has actually done anything? The Iranians are under enormous pressure because of the Trump administration sanctions, and it's not abundantly clear that they've yielded. They've dug in. They've grunted it out. Now there's going to be a new administration that may negotiate a deal with them. What about this gives you, from a historical perspective, confidence that these less than muscular techniques, or maybe less than de regime techniques, will drive the desired outcomes?
Yeah, so
moderated
first,
outcomes you seek.
First, to go back to your strategic empathy concept and what that means, and I've heard HR talk about it and read his book, and it also means not just trying to get in the mind of the other country, but recognizing that our policies have limits in their power and influence. And that the world's not always about us, and that outcomes aren't always the result of what we do. So you talk about how under the Trump administration, China seized, or effectively seized Hong Kong. Well, yeah, and that was Trump, who was trying to get tough on China in many ways. And one thing, you know, so it didn't work. If being tough was the way to stop it, it didn't work. Now, you could say, well, why didn't we use military force to defend Taiwan? But that question answers itself, because it would be insanity. And nobody, I don't remember one person proposing that in the entire U.S. debate. And so there are some things that are just beyond our reach. Now, with Taiwan, I'm not suggesting that we consider the problem beyond our reach, but I am suggesting we're not going to regain the kind of American technological and military preeminence we had in and around the waters and airspace of Taiwan, where, you know, in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s and 90s, we could pretty much do what we wanted, literally within eyesight of the Chinese coast, and they couldn't touch us. Those days are gone for good. They've got dozens of quiet submarines. They've got some, increasing substantially powerful fourth generation aircraft working on fifth generation. They've got all sorts of missiles. They've got sensors, some of which we could theoretically incapacitate, and others of which are so proliferated around that battle space because it's so close to Chinese shores that the notion that we won't be able to, that China wouldn't be able to target us is remarkably ambitious. So I think when you're dealing with Taiwan, the better part of wisdom and of strategic empathy is to get serious about the limitations of what you can and can't do, and to think more about an asymmetric strategy that would pressure China in other parts of the region and the world, with, for example, interdiction of oil headed for China in the event that China tries to blockade Taiwan. I would also try to help Taiwan develop a defense that buys them time. And I don't really think China can invade Taiwan. Amphibious assault is very hard in the modern era of precision strike. China could, however, do a very effective blockade. And so Taiwan needs various kinds of tools that help it be resilient against blockade. Some of that could be anti-maritime, anti-ship capabilities. Some of that could be stockpiles of the right sorts of medicine and other things you would need to buy time to give our strategy time to work, because our effort to interdict Chinese sea lanes is going to take longer than what China could do to Taiwan if it's unprepared. And so I'm trying to be realistic in the simplest sense of the word, the purest sense of the word, not talking about IR theory, international relations theory, but talking about just common sense. Taiwan's getting pretty darn hard to defend directly. And so we just need to be more clever. Also, China still depends on exports for a much higher fraction of its total economic output than most modern Western countries. And Western countries together are far richer than China. And so to the extent that's still going to be true for a number of years or even a couple of decades, I think that we need to use that as part of our strategy. And we recognize that if and when China attacks Taiwan, other countries may not want to fight with us against China, but a lot of them can probably be persuaded to limit their economic dealings, especially if they have tried to develop resilient strategies in advance. So that's the task for strategists right now, is to think about ways to diversify dependence on Chinese raw materials and component goods, such that even though everyone is somewhat vulnerable to Chinese economic retaliation, no one's very survival as a nation hinges on it. And I think that's the way you craft a more realistic strategy.
So to the crafting of that realistic strategy, right, the Biden administration rightly said the only thing that China really responds to is collected, concerted international pressure. And a friend of mine who was a senior in the Reagan administration told me the way that we negotiated with Japan was when we got away from just doing semiconductor like for like, but that we brought the totality of the relationship in, putting pressure on sealing and whaling and all of the things that Japan did not want under a spotlight. And yet, despite this call that Biden made to democracies, I want to work with you to craft both a collective diplomatic, but as well as trade strategy, both nations in Asia and in Europe basically told them to screw off and struck deals for their own interests, right? To both from a perspective of Asian nations, but as well as for European nations, right? For Germany, car exports were important and that trumped it. It's a two-part question. We want to engage and work with allies, but are allies over us, A? B, what does a concerted global strategy look like? And what are the subtle and maybe not so subtle things that we can do that are non-military that continuously shape Chinese behavior toward better outcomes rather than the somewhat more risk-tolerant ones that they seem to be leaning toward?
A couple of things. Well, first of all, combining that question with your earlier one about when have economic sanctions worked, again, I would submit that they don't produce overnight and perfect results. That's true. But when Donald Trump met with Kim Jong-un in Hanoi in early 2019, he heard Kim demand a lifting of U.S. sanctions as the essential prerequisite for any kind of success, which suggested that already at that point, the international sanctions on North Korea were working to an extent. Now, they did not produce complete capitulation. Kim Jong-un did not bring along his 50 nuclear warheads and deliver them up to Donald Trump as a present. He didn't offer to denuclearize, but I think he was basically saying, I'll do some kind of a deal as long as I keep some of my nuclear capability. Unfortunately, the Trump administration didn't really explore what that might mean, and we never got progress. But that went to show that sanctions had some effect on North Korea. We also know that Iran did sign the 2015 nuclear deal with the Obama administration after a period of international sanctions. Now, that was not as good of a deal as some people believe we could have attained, but it was nonetheless a reflection that sanctions had a certain bite. And I believe that Vladimir Putin is at least aware of the reality that if we're prepared and the European Union is prepared to put sanctions on him in response to, you know, biting off small little pieces of Ukraine, which historically he could argue were even Russian to begin with, how much more would we be resolute in doing so if he were to try to nibble along, you know, NATO territory or even attack a NATO country? I think he knows if he attacks a NATO country outright, that means war. But I think he's also seen that we have some pretty impressive tools short of war that even, you know, our beleaguered and often insulted or, you know, non-burden sharing European friends are often willing to sustain. And Europe's gone through 7 years now of post-Crimea, post-Donbass aggression, and it's kept sanctions on Russia throughout. So that's been a substantially greater cost to European economies than the sanctions that we've had to impose here in the United States against Russia. And so I would suggest that we've got some tools. And what you have to do is place economic tools in their proper perspective, but not get into this either or debating whether they produce absolute, quick, perfect outcomes, which they don't, or whether they do nothing at all. And that's also untrue. And so that's the way I would begin to think about strategy in response to your general question. In response to China specifically, you know, there are pieces of what Trump did that I think point us in useful directions. For example, the whole effort to limit Chinese acquisition of high technology assets in Western countries. That's a good general principle that we didn't have before. We didn't have before the last 5 years or so. We used to be very restrictive about trade in, you know, nuclear weapons technology and a couple other things, but otherwise pretty much open up the you know, the floodgates. And we don't do that anymore. We don't let the Chinese buy American companies with, you know, cutting edge capabilities. We are very wary about intellectual property transfer. We still haven't found all the tools to prevent theft, but we are much more aware of the problem. And I think that's one big piece of the equation is to be much more skeptical of any Chinese role in international high-tech commerce acquisition and trade. Also, we need to avoid dependencies where China exceeds more than a certain percent. Probably the percentage depends on what technology or what commodity you're talking about. But, you know, maybe as a rough rule of thumb, China should never account for more than 50 to 60% of your total requirement for any key component of sort of, you know, strategic heights technology that's needed for your country to advance and survive, whether it's medicine, rare earth metals, electronic components, anything that could be deemed strategic in those sorts of ways. We need to be willing to subsidize, if necessary, the creation of alternative supplies so we don't depend excessively on China, such that if a crisis happens, China cannot out-escalate us in terms of economic warfare. Those are just a couple of broad principles that I would begin with.
Where does cyber, Michael, fall on this? Because we've seen this unprecedented Russian attack on the United States. China has been pilfering technology and information for a very long time. This has fallen, and we've regarded this as sort of legitimate intelligence operations. What kind of global approach do we need to this to sort of indicate more rules of the road on what's acceptable and what's not? Because our sense has been this is legitimate espionage because we do similar sorts of things.
Well, I guess, you know, without trying to give a big, long answer on cyber, where others are better equipped than I anyway, I would say just two things. One is that on China, if we know that intellectual property has been stolen and has then benefited a certain company or a certain industry in China, we should be willing to sanction that sector of the Chinese economy such that it cannot easily sell goods back to Western consumers. That's another piece of an overall strategy. And I'm not going to claim to know in dollars and cents terms what percentage is adequate or even what body should make the decisions. I think the decision making has to be multilateral, though. But that would be a piece of, a, you know, again, a broader economic strategy vis-a-vis China that's not entirely unfriendly, but but that places certain limitations on especially the higher tech areas, and especially, as you say, those where either they've played unfair or where there's particular military significance. And then on cyber intelligence gathering, we should make a huge distinction between anything we can find, let's say Russia recently did, to just get inside our networks and read your emails to me, or, you know, yours to the Dalai Lama or to President-elect Biden or whoever else you're in touch with. And most of us do want to know what Vago's saying to those people. And certainly Russians want to know too. And as you say, we would want to know what they're writing to each other. And you can bet we're trying to do that kind of espionage against them. So that stuff, I don't think you punish. You try to prevent, but you don't punish. But what you do punish is when they have inserted a trapdoor that lets them bring down an electricity grid, even if it's just an implied threat against an electricity grid, for example, as opposed to an actual cyber attack. I think you can view the preparation for cyber attack as itself unfriendly and meriting response in kind, or response that's largely in the economic realm, but combined with greater military measures on our own part to make sure we're resilient. So that, you know, for example, I would take the fact that we do know Russia has had some designs on our electricity grid as evidence that we are not protecting it well enough, and that the current system that says DOD protects its own computers, DHS protects other government computers, and the private sector in the United States protects itself. I don't agree with that model anymore. I don't think it's robust enough in protecting the kind of infrastructure, some of which is privately owned or operated, that we depend on not only for our economy, but even for moving our military forces and communicating with them. So I think we got to change that model. I'm no longer comfortable with the, you know, with that triage system of, again, DOD protecting only its own computers, DHS protecting the rest of government, and nobody except individuals or companies protecting the private sector. I think that model's got to be revisited.
Let me take you to the notion as we go into the lightning round here. What are, you know, at this time of strategy, Michael, and you're not just the scholar, right, but a student of strategy in the history of strategy. What is, you know, give us an example of good strategy that's worth emulating in this time, right, from the past. And what's bad strategy? And I get a sense, right, the Schlieffen approach might be a bad one to highlight, but what would sort of be good and bad from your standpoint that folks should bear in mind, both as cautionary tales, but also as guiding lights?
Well, let me go back to George Kennan, because I cited him before, and I'm going to actually use him for both. I think he was, for the most part, a genius and very thoughtful. But he also contributed to a big mistake. And so the genius part was after World War II, when we were still pretty strong, but our allies certainly were not, and the whole world was in some unrest and even jeopardy. Kennan said, let's remember the most important parts of the world from the point of view of industrial and military capability. And it's North America, the British Isles, Western European industrial zone centered on the Rhine River and other parts of France and the Low Countries and Western Germany. So that was the third, Russia or Soviet Union at the time, and Japan. Those were the five. But he said, we've got to make sure that those five don't get, you know, somehow subsumed within, let's say, the broader Soviet orbit, and protect those adamantly. That created some of the logic for the formation of NATO, which, by the way, Kennan himself was against creating at the time, but later acknowledged had worked out better than he expected, and maybe was a good idea after all. That was good strategy because it prioritized and it helped organize thinking. And it didn't also try to answer every question. It tried to recognize that there'd be an ongoing thought process, but he started the process and he created a structure that we could then employ to refine. The example where he got it wrong, though, like many people in the late 40s, was not really knowing our own mind about Korea. And Kennan's perimeter did not include Korea, and neither did Dean Acheson's. And we publicly telegraphed to North Korean leadership, to Moscow, to Beijing, that we would not fight in defense of South Korea. And then lo and behold, when the North attacked the South after that American green light, we realized that we had not even known our own mind, because then we saw South Korea not so much as important in its own right, but as, you know, as a domino, if you will. And that's where the domino theory began to become more prevalent in our thinking. And we felt that if it was attacked so blatantly, it became an interest, even without having initially been one. So right. I'm not suggesting that we, you know, if Vladimir Putin invades Belarus tomorrow, that we now have decided that Belarus is a threat. I don't think that Vladimir Putin today is like the communists of old because he doesn't have the same global expansionist ideology. He wants to have a sphere of influence for Russia. He doesn't want a communist ideology. So I'm not suggesting that we have to define everything as a core interest, but I believe anticipating what our country would really be willing to do in response to certain kinds of threats or attacks is an important element of strategy, which Kennan did not do very well in regard to Korea.
Let me ask you about the implications of the foreign policy and strategic implications of the United States' abject mismanagement of not just COVID and the pandemic, but now the inoculations and vaccinations regime is not good. And then the assault or the storming of the Capitol, and that nearly 150 members of the upper and lower houses suspended reality and voted in a way that has even their closest allies sort of baffled, right? That if they went for a hoax like that, that they really can't be trusted to make good decisions on behalf of the nation. What does all of this mean from the standpoint of American prestige in what is a competitive and dangerous world? Do enemies and allies need to take pause?
Well, on COVID, you know, I think that the Trump presidency writ large, what the Trump presidency has shown us is just how strong we are in some ways, even with a president who's disruptive or frankly, at times asleep at the switch, and also how dependent we still are on Washington. So a lot of our alliances still worked, even when Trump vocally criticized or dismissed them. For example, a lot of our economy chugged along, even when Trump and Democrats and Congress couldn't really cooperate. We went through a lot of rancor, a lot of nasty political rhetoric 4 years, and we come out with the strongest stock market we've ever had, et cetera, et cetera. So there are some things where if we're just going to be asked to keep doing what we're already doing and doing pretty well, we're probably okay, even with a president who's not helping and maybe even actively opposing in certain ways. On the other hand, when a new crisis arises, that is by its very nature, national or global in scale, and you need a strong guiding arm, and there's only one option for who that could be, then you really suffer from having a president who views this primarily as a, you know, political threat to his own reelection or whatever else. Now, some things Trump got right on COVID, most notably the accelerated development and production of vaccine. So I'm not suggesting that he botched it all, nor am I suggesting that a perfect response would have had us out of the woods by now. And we see in Europe, for example, that they looked a lot better than the United States in the summer, but now they're probably half as bad on average as we are. But, you know, if we could have just cut the death rate in half to follow that same hypothetical line of reasoning, we'd be much better off than we are. And that would have required a serious government thinking about how to manage the question of openness versus shutdown. So when there's a new crisis, and it's national or international in scope, you need capability in Washington. That's what I've learned from the COVID piece. From the issue of internal cohesion and American prestige and credibility, you know, the United States has made big mistakes before in its foreign policy. In fact, I don't believe that American exceptionalism means that we are smarter or more ethical than other people. I think it means that we have a constitution and sort of a melting pot demographic that makes us unusual because we're focused on the rights of the individual rather than of a certain ethnic group or a certain historical tradition. And because our geography is such that we can go and be an honest broker or a balancer or, you know, a fireman in parts of the world that are important to us, but far enough away that we're not sort of part of the day-to-day mix in every case. And so it's our geography plus our constitution, as opposed to our ethics or our brilliance, that make us exceptional. And therefore, even in the aftermath of a Donald Trump presidency, I'm still hopeful that if we recover, and by the way, figure out how not to reelect him, heaven forbid, And I'm sorry to be blunt, but I would find that a travesty. And I'm not going to apologize to Republican friends for saying so. I hope my good Republican friends will find a better person to nominate in 2024 than former President Trump. But if we can show that we are essentially back on the international leadership path, we don't necessarily have to be brilliant or even always ethical to get things right. And so in that sense, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that countries will still say, you know what, being allied to a big, powerful democracy that's often a blundering, late to the game, not very thoughtful, internally divided, behemoth. But that's still better than being out here in the security environment of our own region by ourselves. And at least those Americans, they make a lot of mistakes, but they elect a new president every 4 or 8 years, and they usually pull out of wars that they've lost or that, that they wind up concluding were mistakes, and they only stay with their forward military forces in countries that invite them to stay. And on balance, this is a pretty good kind of ally to have, even if we wish the Americans were a lot nicer and smarter than they actually are. That's how I think some countries look at us. And I'm being a little facetious, but I actually think there's a lot of truth to that. And therefore, the bar is not quite as high as some say for us to be admired and loved around the world in order to preserve some of the structures of the rules-based order today.
Let me ask you one last question. You've studied radicalization. You advised the Pentagon and other arms of government during Afghanistan, Iraq, over Syria, Libya. And at the end of the day, there are enormous numbers of parallels, right? I mean, there are tens of millions of Americans who believe that the election was stolen, who reside in a disinformation ecosystem. And in fact, the radicalization and self-radicalization mirrors what we've seen, whether it's with the Taliban or with ISIS or anybody else. I'm not drawing parallels or conclusions. I'm not saying the two are the same, but they're heavily armed, believe that they are in the right, that they are doing the moral thing to develop to defend their faith or their idea or their culture. At the end of the day, Michael, how our efforts to de-radicalize people around the world dealt more with us killing them in large numbers and using that as a deterrent tool. Obviously, allies, including Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and others, worked the language of how Islam was being taught, which became an important thing. But at the end of the day, how does the United States deal with this? Because there is, over the next coming days, a very real possibility that even more violent protests will break out against Washington and against state capitals, and that we're beginning to recognize that this problem may be a bigger problem. It took us decades to get there. How do we address this radicalization problem? Because the republic doesn't survive unless everybody shares truth.
You're right, and I'm worried. But I also will say I was just in Washington today, and I saw at a bus stop a number of faces of people whose images had been captured on January 6th, and the authorities were asking for help in finding them. And if I were one of those eight people, I'd be scared. And, I think they had a president egging them on. They didn't really know. They had forgotten that we Americans can be pretty hard ass, if that's a word I can use on your show. When we think that law and order is at risk or our own safety and security, Americans are not particularly pacifist or even necessarily particularly nice people when they feel threatened. And, we're talking about charging a lot of the January 6th plotters with insurrection and sedition. These are pretty big words. And I think people are going to find out we're serious. And so right-wing militia proponents are going to have to factor that into their calculus. I hope more than one or two of them are shaking a little bit in their boots these days, because this is no longer a political debate. This is a question of physical safety and survival of Americans in this country. And people who challenge that are criminals and really will be prosecuted and really will be put in jail. And Donald Trump won't be in position to pardon them. So, think on that. I'm still hopeful that we're actually not going to see this metastasize into something even worse.
I hope not. But how do you fight the radicalization part of it, right? So there's the punitive element of it. Then there is the broader societal pressure, right? I mean, people going to guys and saying, hey, look, this has kind of gone far enough. But if you live deep down in that hole, maybe down is easier to go rather than up toward the light, right? I mean, how do we need to address this when there is a large commercial ecosystem that profits from the propagation of these falsehoods that then precipitate existential questions?
Well, recognizing that you and I, and more importantly, your listeners need to go, let me just say very briefly that yes, we need to listen. And that's why after Donald Trump won the first time, I realized I had been a little remiss in understanding some of the grudges and resentments and fears of middle-class America, for lack of a better term. That's way too broad of a term, but you know what I mean. And we had a middle-class project at Brookings, and we still do. And we have, you know, race relations projects at Brookings. And, you know, we were focused more on sort of the angry white man, the hillbilly elegy, you know, you name it. And all that's important and should be ongoing. And we never should think, never should use the phrase that Hillary did about how half the Trump supporters are a basket of deplorables. That's not the way to talk about our fellow Americans. However, when people use violence, we have to crack down. And the message that needs to be heard now by conspirators, especially because we're talking in this period when everything is still fresh, you do this again, we will crack down even harder and we will be better prepared next time. Shame on us for being unprepared the first time. We won't be unprepared the second. So that law and order message needs to be part of the answer too. And with that, I will wish you the best, Vago, and thank you for having me on.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure, and already looking forward to having you on again. Thanks so much.
Fantastic. Thanks, my friend. Best wishes.